Dawn Anahid McKean's new book, The 100-Year Walk, An Armenian Odyssey, is an epic tale of one man's courage in the face of the Armenian genocide and his granddaughter's quest to tell his story nearly a century later and telling her own story in the process. McKean is an award-winning journalist who spent nearly a decade on her grandfather's story. Previously, she covered health and social issues for Salon, Smart Money, and Newsday, where her investigative series on assisted living facilities, Poor Care, helped prompt legislative reform. Again, the title of the book is The 100-Year Walk, An Armenian Odyssey. It is a great pleasure to welcome Dawn McKean to this morning's roundtable. Dawn, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Very nice to have you on the program. This obviously is a very personal story. At what point did you come to it?
Well, my mother has been telling me the story of what her father endured since I can remember. During breakfast, during dinner, birthday party, any occasion was the right time to tell me and my, you know, my whole family about what happened to her father. And while I had grown up listening to these stories, I really didn't comprehend what he endured, because you can't quite comprehend a history that dark until you're older. And I really didn't understand what happened until I read my grandfather's journals after they'd been translated from Armenian into English.
Your grandfather left 6 journals. They were very meticulous. He added pretty much everything to them.
Absolutely. And the way that my mother and her brother described it is that he would talk about it nonstop. It was almost as if he were trying to purge it from his soul. He witnessed so many people die that he felt that it was his duty to tell people what happened, to bear witness.
You had been working on this for quite a while.
Yes. Well, I thought it would be a 2-year-long project, and it ended up taking me a decade.
What happened? Why was it so difficult for you?
Well, when I started, I thought that perhaps there'd be more people who were alive who could attest to what they witnessed. And, of course, when I started researching and looking into it, there were very few survivors still around. And that made it difficult. As a reporter, I'm used to interviewing people live. And so that began many years of research into documents and trying to find additional testimonies to expand my grandfather's account. And it really took me around the world. And I drew from materials in 6 different countries. And the materials were also in all different languages, because if you think about the surviving Armenians, they scattered around the globe after the genocide. And so did their accounts. And their accounts were in French, they were in Ottoman Turkish, they were in Arabic, English, Armenian, and unfortunately, I am not that skilled in other languages, so it took a long time to go through, to not only find the documents, but then to also translate them and to translate them.
Your extensive travel brought you to Turkey and Syria, and quite frankly, most if not all of the places that you went to for research, you would not be able to go to today.
No, not at all. I went to Turkey and Syria in 2007, and it was about a 2-month-long trip across 1,000 miles, and I was retracing my grandfather's steps. Reading about my grandfather's experience was not enough for me. I had to see the land that he walked and barely survived. I had to go to these places, and unfortunately, 100 years later, we're seeing crimes of humanity committed in the very same region where my grandfather barely survived and many other Armenians lost their lives.
2 million Armenians were slaughtered in 1915, and this ultimately is a story of your grandfather who miraculously survived. Were you able to figure out, even, I guess, at what point were you able to figure out how he indeed did survive?
Yes, more than a million Armenians lost their lives, more than half the population during World War One, during the genocide. And my grandfather, he was about to die so many different times. If you turn the pages, it's just of his journals, you just can't believe that he lived. But he was always thinking ahead. He was very cunning and was always thinking about, what's my next step? How can I live? What can I do? When's my next opportunity to break from either the caravan with the gendarmes that were walking alongside him and watching him, or in the camps? And, you know, it was both that. He was extremely resourceful. Of course, there's luck involved as well. And also a very strong will to survive. His courage and his conviction and his desire to see his family again was extraordinary, and I believe that helped carry him through. Another reason he survived, in which I talk about in the 100-year walk, is because after he escaped from his caravan, which nearly everyone else was killed, he heard about this sympathetic Arab sheikh nearby. And he approached that man and even disguised his identity. My grandfather disguised his identity and pretended he was a Muslim Arab so this man would accept him. But the Arab sheikh knew who my grandfather was and accepted him anyway. And my grandfather became like a son to this man.
When you went through the journals, what did you want to use, and how ultimately did you fill in the blanks from those journals?
It was his journals. I'm a reporter, so his journals, it was kind of a reporter's dream. He was extremely meticulous. He would write down the amount of change in his pocket and how it would change over the different days, what he ate. He would say the month he was in a certain camp or location. And extremely important for me is that he listed the names of others alongside him. He would name their first name, their last name, and the village they were from. So these were all clues to me. And I took these clues and just researched and tried to find out what happened to these people, which ones survived, and where did they go, and did they leave any accounts. And in one case, I knew this one man survived the same caravan as my survived this massacre in which my grandfather had narrowly escaped. So I knew this man was a writer, and it was just a deep conviction of mine that he had to have written about this same night in which everyone else was killed. And it took me years, but I did finally find his account, which was published in a Romanian Armenian newspaper in the 1920s.
Talk a little bit about your travels, and I assume that even though you were allowed to travel there at the time, where you would not be today, there were still great dangers in what you were doing.
Yes, it was before the war, so Syria was a much different place then. It still was almost like a police state, where if you're a foreigner, you're followed. And for Syrians, it was almost business as usual, where you would expect to be followed. For a Westerner like myself, it was extremely uncomfortable and worrisome. And to be just followed everywhere you went, you know, to kind of continue to have this shadow no matter what you did. And for me, I think what started out as ordinary kind of, it escalated into something more serious, where it was very worrisome for me when I was thinking about leaving the country and wanting to leave the country. But that said, this is nothing compared to what's going on today, and it almost seems somewhat peaceful when you look at it through the lens of what's happening today.
But you were followed, and you even heard that it was thought you were a spy for Israel.
Yes, I learned that after I left, and I'm glad that I didn't know that when I was there. So, yes, it was very, very worrisome, and I think the questioning that the people, my contacts there, what they endured after I left, yeah, it was very concerning to me.
You talk about the questioning. The intelligence agents harassed pretty much everyone that you spoke to.
That's my understanding, yes, yeah. After I left. Yes.
You write about Raqqa in the book, and now headquarters for the Islamic State, the same area.
Yes, absolutely. I visited Raqqa twice, once during my initial trip to the region in 2007, and then I returned again in 2009. I experienced the complete opposite of what we're seeing and hearing about Raqqa today. The Raqqa that I visited was a town that had an Armenian church. The Raqqa that I visited, I went out to dinner with a local Bedouin sheikh who treated me to dinner on the Euphrates at night with music and with people of different faiths gathered around the table. It was a nice community that was not separated by these divisions of religion or ethnicity.
Obviously, this is the story of your grandfather. Your story is very much included as well. At what point did you know that you were going to start to include your story as well?
I did not know until I went on the trip. I initially followed my grandfather's footsteps from Turkey into Syria just because I wanted to see the land and I wanted to be able to describe it accurately. I felt that I couldn't write this book unless I saw the land that he was talking about and understood the relationship, you know, the distance between certain towns and what he walked, and to see the desert, which was extremely flat. But it was only after I went on this journey and retracing his steps, and especially when I found the family of the Arab sheikh who saved my grandfather's life, which was a transformative moment for me to arrive to their village and to have 300 people greet me and hold a feast for me and whisk me off and give me a beautiful dress and headscarf and honor me. And I was able to thank this clan for saving my grandfather's life. And I discovered all these generations later, they're just as beautiful as that man was when he took in my grandfather.
You talk in the book about how your grandfather would repeatedly tell your mother that I'm going to die next year, something that he said all of the time, believing that his death sentence was always very close. And it gives you an idea of just how much the genocide affected your family and continues to affect you and your family.
Yes, my mother would recount about how her father would tell her every single year he was going to die, and he just never quite believed that he had survived. And it also affected him. It affected him throughout his life. And even on my parents' wedding day, my grandfather almost didn't come because he didn't really feel that he deserved to experience joy when so many others had lost their lives.
When you visit Turkey and you realize that Turkey still denies that this even happened, does that make it difficult to go to the place and to even understand their point of view?
When I visited in 2007, it was a very charged time with the Armenians and the Turks and this issue. This Turkish-Armenian editor had just been assassinated months earlier. And so I was very fearful to go there. Also, just growing up with these stories, and of course it's 100 years later, but in your family, it's a very real and intimate history. But when I went there, it demystified the issue for me. First of all, it's not the Turks of today who committed these atrocities. It was the Ottoman Empire. And I believe that it comes down to education. The Turkey today denies that it occurred and teaches its populace that this didn't happen. They teach them a very different history. But I believe with the digital age, people can educate themselves. And I truly hope that the Armenians and the Turks can heal. It's a very tragic history, and my mother and I just would love for there to be an understanding of what happened so we can all heal.
The name of the book is The 100-Year Walk, an Armenian Odyssey. It is published by Houghton Mifflin Harcourt. Dawn Anahid McKean, thank you so much for being with us and sharing the story. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks so much. Again, the title of the book, The 100-Year Walk, an Armenian Odyssey. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.